for the KRVS listening area. 20% chance of showers this afternoon and this evening. Low this evening of about 73 degrees, winds from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. A 20% chance of showers stays with us throughout tomorrow afternoon, going up to a 40% chance overnight on Thursday. Currently, there are a few clouds. It's 91 here on the campus of UL Lafayette. Coming up at 4 o'clock, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. We're going to begin this hour by going into the interview studio with Judith Merriweather.
And with us in the KRVS studios this afternoon are three artists. I'm really happy to have them here. I'm always happy to have artists here. These three have donated pieces to KRVS, and they adorn our walls. Susan David, Stephanie Patton, and Reggie Michael Rodri. In fact, Susan David's painting is behind me. All three of them are looking at it right now. It's really a gorgeous piece. So we really appreciate that. You all are very busy trying to create spaces for people to make art, find out more about art, make art yourselves, educate people. Stephanie, I know you work in the schools. So you do various things in our community. You're very passionate about art. I think all of you have been connected with UL in some way or another, either as a student or working, teaching. So a lot of great connections here in art. And Susan, just recently, within the past year, you started Freetown Studios. Is it just within the year, isn't it?
That's correct. Yeah.
Tell us about Freetown Studios. It is a nonprofit organization now. I think you just received your designation, or you're in the process of
No, we received our designation in March of 2011, and we had a soft opening at the end of October of 2011.
So you're open for nonprofit business. Well, tell us about Freetown Studios. I know you've been in here before, but for those of our listeners who perhaps didn't catch what you were saying about it, what was your vision for Freetown?
The vision is to provide studio production workspace in the form of a cooperative for artists to provide space, equipment, and machinery, artistic support, and to specialize in printmaking, but to also involve other forms of visual arts and multimedia disciplines.
Mm-hmm. So describe the space for us.
It is an open warehouse space. We have 4,000 square feet plus a large parking lot that is fenced in, and we're located at 421 East Convent Street, 70501.
And that area where you are is designated as Freetown, or informally.
Yes, it's the neighborhoods of Freetown and Puerto Rico. They're historic neighborhoods in Lafayette, and they have quite a bit of charm and character.
So you officially opened this past year. You got a grant for a series of presentations.
Yes.
Tell us about that grant.
Yes, we wrote through the Decentralized Arts Fund for project assistance, and we wrote for the Freetown Studios Artist Workshops. And it paid for a year of programming to have artists come in and give lectures, demonstrations, gallery shows. I've had musicians come in and perform.
You've had writers reading.
Yes, readings. It's just been, it ran the gamut of the arts, really. It was definitely a multimedia combination of artists coming together.
Yeah, it's been really quite an exuberant year over there.
Oh, yeah, it's kept me busy.
Well, and quite a few other people as well. I know Reggie Michael Rodrigue, who is an artist in our community, as well as an art scholar and critic, has been quite involved with Freetown Studios as well. And we had you on earlier in the spring to talk about, a couple talks that you gave at Freetown Studios. As an artist and an observer of art, art critic, a writer about art, what do you think about it? What is the importance of a place like Freetown Studios? Because I think there are a lot of people who have this image of the solitary artist just in their little garret or someplace, slaving away over there painting.
I think Freetown is vitally important. Mm-hmm. We have places like the Acadiana Center of the Arts that fill, one niche in the community. You have the Hilliard, Art Museum on the UL campus that fills another. Freetown is, I think what's great about Freetown is that it's a little bit more accessible, a little bit more down to earth, but also I think it can be more responsive to the community than those other places. Not that they're not responsive, but, you know, they operate on these, like, long timelines where they're preparing for things.
A year in advance. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Whereas over here at Freetown, we have a little bit more flexibility. So I'm not saying that it's better, but it's just a different art experience. And I think that just adds to the flavor of the arts in Lafayette. It feels, you know, a hole that's been missing for quite a while.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've been observing the art scene in Lafayette and the surrounding area for quite a while now. Describe that to us. Again, for those people who perhaps we aren't artists ourselves, you know, or we're not really, we don't go to galleries a lot. What is that? From someone from the outside, how would you describe the art scene in this area?
I would describe it as it's quite a mix. You've got the gamut running as far, especially now with Freetown mm-hmm. being open. You've got quite a gamut going on as far as being able to see folk artists, you know, who have always been around in Lafayette. And you've got the university sending out, you know, professionalized artists, basically.
Like yourselves.
who are kind of like expanding the context of what art can be in our city. I mean, a couple of days ago, I was at the AACA, and a patron came in, and she was looking at the Southern Open, and her eyes were just wide open, and she was like, you know, oh my God, you know, 10, 20 years down the line, you know, I would have never have thought that this could be art, mm-hmm. you know, or this is what art was going to become. So, you know, that's the great thing about Lafayette is you have this wide range of experience that you can go out and see, you know.
Mm-hmm. So many different styles of art, so many different generations of artists
here. So many different styles, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, Stephanie in and of herself is a very unique commodity in our community. You know, her art, it doesn't look like anything else that, you know, that is around.
Stop it, Reg.
Well, I think the one thing people find just so fascinating about this area is what you're saying. There's so many different styles, all the way from, you know, our folk artists who are sketching scenes of life in Acadiana, all the way to extremely contemporary young artists like Stephanie, like yourselves. You can find everything here. And I think people don't expect it. But I think one of the things that you're saying that Freetown offers is it's another way to experience it and observe it. Because sometimes it's, you know, we have Second Saturday Art Walk, which is really nice, but we aren't always able to encounter those artists who are working in our community on such an intimate level as you might find.
Exactly. It's a much more intimate space, a much more intimate way to get to know art and artists. You know, there isn't that sort of formality that you'll find at other places. And that formality deserves to be there in certain places. I'm not, you know, mm-hmm. down, you know, getting down on that. But it's just another way to connect, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, and in looking at the series that Susan has had through this wonderful DAF grant at Freetown Studios, personally, what have you gotten out of experiencing all the variety of artists who have appeared at Freetown Studios?
It's been exceptional. You know, the feeling of community that we're building over there, I think, is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been a really kind of amazing journey in a very short period of time to see all the things that have happened over there and the way that everybody has come together. And I think that's going to be like a hallmark of really the really powerful and important art of the 20th century is this idea of, you know, social space and connectivity and doing things for your community. I think those are going to be big hallmarks of art in our century. So I'm really proud of what we're doing over there right now.
If you have just tuned in, I want to tell you my guests are Susan David, Stephanie Patton, and Reggie Michael Roderick. Susan David started Freetown Studios this past year, a space for artists and all kinds of creative activity. Reggie has been involved over there and has done some lectures, and Stephanie is going to give a lecture tomorrow evening, an artist talk tomorrow evening at Freetown Studios. Stephanie, you've been in our studios a few times, and as I mentioned, we have some of your artwork, this wonderful installation piece in our hallway. You've been working and creating in Lafayette for a number of years now. Tell us just a bit about your background as an artist, where you work.
Well, I graduated from UL way back. Then I went to Chicago for grad school. Then I moved to Brooklyn, stayed there for a while, and then I moved back to Lafayette. I guess it's almost 10 years ago now. And I taught as an adjunct at UL and at the community college, a juggling routine. And finally, I have a great job that I love as a talented visual arts teacher for the Lafayette Parish School System. And I'm thrilled to be given this talk, FYI, because I think that this...
We're thrilled to have you.
I think it's going to be fun, first of all. I'm excited to be able to show a little bit of a, you know, spectrum of the work that I've done for all ages, and especially maybe for a younger artist coming out of UL who, you know, I think it's a really hard time. I thought after grad school was probably the hardest time of my life in terms of, are you going to do it or not? And that's when it really gets down to it.
Are you going to do art?
Yes. Yes. Are you going to, what is going to compel you to continue to be an artist? Because there are no deadlines. At that point, there were none for me. It's like, what are you going to do to make it happen?
And there's really no job description that says, you're an artist, come work for us. There's not someone saying, oh, you graduated, you learned how to paint, we want you to work for
us. Yeah, no.
That job doesn't really...
No, I think it's years of just persistence. I believe that persistence does pay off. Mm-hmm. Hopefully some talent. And just, just this desire that won't go away to do something creative. I do think that what they're doing with Freetown Studios, I think that it's a great time to be doing something like this in Lafayette. A friend of mine, Kathy Gilbert's a city planner here, and they're working on some major comprehensive plan. Lafayette is booming, and they're getting ready. Joey Durrell, I went to one of these meetings, and a community meeting, and they're looking to spend like millions of dollars on Lafayette. That's a whole other story. But what they are doing right now, I think Lafayette's it's a great time to be doing this, because you see it just with all of the biking and all the interest in food, all of this organic food, everything. Mm-hmm. I think that's all intertwined in what they're doing with the younger community or all ages. It's just a nice, exciting time for this to happen.
The whole topic of creativity.
Yeah.
But what you said that you'll be addressing as well and hoping to be talking to younger artists, that is a very current topic. So many young artists coming to Lafayette, either returning or moving here. And just what you said earlier about having graduated from UL, living in the Midwest, living on the East Coast, but yet coming back here.
Mm-hmm.
And why did you come back? I mean, I know we all probably have family stories, but people would ordinarily think you get out of school, you go to one of those huge communities that have great museums, so much art there. Why would you leave that?
I was working at Pratt Institute. I had a great job, the director of grad and international admissions. It was crazy. It was awesome. And I left. Actually, I saw some of my other great artist friends sort of, they came back for various reasons. And really, I came back sooner than I expected to. I was there as an administrator in a great school, but I thought I should be teaching. And that's when I would see people as practicing artists, same education, whatever. They were going off to teach their classes, yet I was the one sending them the students. And I thought, I'm on a track. I could go in this direction, or I could switch directions and get on what I really need to do. Because I think that teaching, a lot of times, if you play your cards right, it is an excellent job as an artist, too. So, and I had the chance to come back, be with my family, and teach as an adjunct at UL, so I did.
All right. But in addition to teaching, which for so many people who have taught, I mean, that in itself is a full-time job, draining you of energy and time. But at the same time, you have maintained your artistic output as well. Tell us just a bit about some of the things you've done over the years since you've come back and started teaching. Just, again, for those people who may not have experienced all of your eras of art.
Well, it's funny because when I was still in New York, I was like, I didn't have a big studio or anything. I was doing a lot of video. Then I started getting more into performance. I started taking comedy classes and singing classes or whatever. And it was really fun. And then, by the way, stand-up comedy was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. But it prepared me for when I moved back here. Taking those classes prepared me. I started doing Ranella Rose Champagne, this character that some people might be aware of. But I started singing and performing a lot with Walter Pierce. And we did that pretty consistently for about 3 years. And I would say that most of my creative efforts were going towards performance, but also installation, photography, based around this character.
You were creating an entire world.
Yeah,
you had
more
newspapers. You had scrapbooks. You had
Ranella's world.
That's right. It was a huge effort.
It was a lot of work. And I have
one of the magnets on my
fridge. Oh, good. I can't hear anything.
I think you're okay.
Okay, sorry. But anyway, I have a lot of respect for performers, and it taught me a lot. And I tried to maintain a visual sensibility to all of that through those years. But then I really missed studio work. And guess what? Even Ranella needs to take a nap. So I was like, I wanted to get back into a studio situation, be in a white box, and all of that stuff. And I went to several artist residencies. I started sewing a lot, doing sculptural work and wall pieces, but still doing video and photography. And I would say that this show that I did, the Equipped in 2008 at the ACA, was a pivotal moment for me. And it's kind of been going in that direction ever since. And I think that this talk that I want to, one of the things I want to talk about is, especially for people who are interested in at least a creative process, everything informed what I'm doing right now. And Ranella did, but also my thesis work at the Art Institute. I see the thread. And
actually, classes.
All of it. All of it makes total sense to me. And I see it, and it's awesome, and I love it. And I hope that, being with all this energy and people who are trying to figure it out, and I'm still figuring it out, and you can always learn from somebody. And if there's a way to keep someone from having to, as they say, reinvent the wheel, if you can save someone a few steps, do it. Why not? I just think that there's a place for everyone, and people can help each other. And we have an awesome community and a lot of very talented people here.
Well, and I think probably, and you've had this experience teaching, there are a lot of students, I'm sure, coming out of art school, university, thinking it's going to be very linear.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to get out of art school, and I'm just going to do what I do best, and that's, it's going to turn into, all three of y'all are shaking your heads.
Yeah, we're like, we know, oh my God.
It's typically anything but.
That's right, we've been out a long time.
Just learn to fly by the seat of your pants real quick, and just pretend.
Pretend's a good word. But recently there was a man who gave a talk at the ACA not too long ago for the Innovate for Creative Action. Emmy Morgan had brought him from Alfred University.
Mm-hmm.
And he studied art history. And when we were talking about where is art going now, kind of like you were saying, Reggie, it's not so much having a particular genre that you're working in, but working in many and doing collaborations. And it is about community and people working together and not just staying in one genre, but sewing, comedy, it all becomes a piece of art, maybe not in the traditional way that we're
thinking. And that's a completely different, completely new way of looking at art. That's a very 21st century.
Right. And something Freetown is reflecting, I guess, in its series of creative people that you bring in.
Who would have thought?
You never know where a place like this could go,
It really is.
Yeah.
It's an open book, and we like that. We hope to solve or provide a lot of space and awareness and just a a creative vibe for people to kind of come together and experience and mm-hmm. cross-fertilize genres and mm-hmm. just soak up experience and then go out and, you know. Right.
And I think we kind of touched on that with when you were talking with Stephanie about learning from each other. I think at any artist, when they're giving a talk or they're talking to another person, they're always learning about themselves from other people as well. Sometimes somebody will go ahead and see something in your art that you've never thought about, or maybe something that was like laying buried down deep inside, but you didn't have the words to articulate it or anything like that. So I think, you know, whenever it comes to a talk such as Stephanie's, the opportunity for the audience to almost be somewhat of an instructor is there as well, you know, because it really is about coming together and sharing, you know, and anybody who comes in and wants to share, you know, that's important, you know. It's really important to us. Mm-hmm. It really is. Mm-hmm.
And obviously giving some perspective, as you said, hopefully to younger artists in the community who may attend. Mm-hmm. But this talk really isn't just for artists. It sounds like it'll be very enlightening for artists, but you're hoping that just
open
general
to
public.
The public.
Oh, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Doors open at 6:30. The talk starts at 7?
7, yeah.
Have some wine and snack.
Yeah. No, I think it's a great chance for all people to meet and make, you know.
Mm-hmm. And really come to some kind of clear, because we're all interested in art. It's all around us mm-hmm. in this community. As you said, it's on the walls, it's in the galleries, it's in festivals, we encounter it a lot. But for many of us, it's kind of opaque, and especially perhaps the more contemporary lines mm-hmm. of art, which you've been working in, mm-hmm. particularly in your white box.
Is this art? No.
Yeah. People could ask that too, I guess. You know?
Sure.
Bring a picture and show Stephanie, and she'll tell you if it's art or not.
No, or they ask that about my own work, and no, it's fine. You know, it's all good, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, describe the piece you have here at KRVS. We have a lot of people come in and...
That was a part of the Equipped show that I mentioned, and that was, you know, that was something that it was kind of, I thought, I guess at that point, there were things, ideas that I had that I wanted to do, and I didn't know. I just, for once, let myself do it. I'm like, get over it. Just do it. And trust yourself enough to do something that you don't even know if it'll be accepted or if it'll be good or whatever. And that's when I really think that piece is called Accelerate. And I had done, it was part of a mixed media installation called Equipped. And it was a lot of sewing. And really that piece supposed to be like looking out of an airplane. But also there are three photographs of these clouds, and I know everyone's taking pictures out of an airplane, of course, but that time it was great, but the clouds were like a blanket. I mean, I thought it was the most beautiful view I've ever seen practically out of an airplane window. And so I had them mounted face up to plexiglass, trying to somewhat resemble an airplane window, mm-hmm. but it's all was conceptually part of, you know, this idea of speed and aging and all of that. Because if you would have seen it in context with the other pieces, like a lot of it was about taking care of my grandmother and her sister, you know, and how these people, how do you protect an elderly person from, you know, hurting themselves physically or, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. helping them. Mm-hmm. And it's a humorous edge to everything that I do.
There was.
But you know, like these SAS shoes that I sent off my grandma's SAS shoes to the American Bronzing Company. Like, and it was at the University Art Museum.
Yeah. That was a lovely exhibit.
Well, thank you.
And we and all of our guests who walk down and see those three airplane windows, we just feel like we're on vacation. You know, we're just like flying.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, is that explaining it? Because it really was, I mean, it's cliche as it might sound, it's about life moving fast too, you know, the whole thing. And
I think what you're saying right now is why so many of us find artist talks fascinating, and listening to artists talk. We all have ideas, we all have feelings, reactions, mm-hmm. but you all make them visible. You all give some kind of incarnation to them and put it outside of your heads and actually create, whether it's sewing or painting or sculpting or printmaking. And it's just so appreciated by everyone. And the more we understand, the more we can appreciate it.
Hopefully. That's what I like to think about, you know.
If you have just tuned in, we're talking about an artist talk that will take place tomorrow evening. My guest, Stephanie Patton, will be giving the talk. Freetown Studios, started by Susan David and Reggie Michael Roderick here, has given artist talk there and thinks about art a lot, writes about art a lot. Tell us just a bit of what you think about Stephanie's work.
I think it's magnificent. I really enjoy Stephanie's work. She just talked about the humor of it. It's also incredibly deep and profound work. At the same time, she manages to make these objects that seem very, very simple. You know, in contemporary art jargon, we call that minimalism. And it's basically reducing a form down to its kind of bare bones. And Stephanie has a way of doing that and at the same time putting so much soul and depth into the piece, which kind of like subverts the whole idea of minimalism at the same time. Her work's very subversive. So it talks about all these things in these very simple forms, and it's humorous, and it sometimes it's underneath, it's kind of dark, and but at the same time it looks very light and cheerful, especially like her objects. You get a little bit more humor in her videos and her performances. So it's this very, very deep, complex work couched in very, very minimal forms. And I find that intensely interesting, the way that she can pack so much into these objects. It takes a real talent. You know,
well, I'm sure some people are wondering, are you going to show slides? Are there going to be examples of your work tomorrow evening?
Yeah, a PowerPoint presentation, and I wanted to show three very short videos that are actually more like excerpts of, you know, I don't want to overload anyone, but I do think some of these videos are an important part of what I'm doing too. Okay. So,
and is there someplace people can go if they're really interested in your work? Do you have a website where people can see some of your work?
Yeah, I have a website, StephaniePatton.com, mm-hmm. that I'm trying desperately to revise, but most of it is there. And I'm also a member of the Front in New Orleans, and which has been a major thing for me. And they also have a great community going on there also. It's nolafront.org would be another place
to see some of your
work. Yeah.
And tomorrow evening, if people are free, you can see some of her work and hear Stephanie talk more about being an artist and give a little perspective on the art world here. Susan David, again, has Freetown Studios. Maybe you can tell people how to get to Freetown again.
Yes, we're located at 421 East Convent, Lafayette, Louisiana, 70501. And you can look us up on Facebook or at www.freetownstudios.org.
Mm-hmm. All right. So Facebook, it's just Freetown Studios.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you can find directions there as well.
Yeah.
Freetown Studios in Lafayette tomorrow evening. Stephanie Patton will be giving a talk at Freetown. And we look forward to more activity there, artist presentations, collaborations, and a place for community to happen. Thank you, all of you, for coming. Reggie Michael Roderick, Stephanie Patton, and Susan David.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And with me in the KRVS studios now is a returning young artist, writer. Wiley Cash is with me in the studios. Wiley got his PhD in English here at UL Lafayette. How long ago was that, Wiley?
I finished my degree in May of 2008.
In 2008, so it's already been 4 years
that
you graduated.
It's crazy. Around this time, I guess 4 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. But you've been very busy. You are now a professor at Bethany College in West Virginia.
That's right.
And some of our listeners may know that our general manager actually taught at Bethany College
a number of years ago
as well. Loved being there for a while. It's kind of a return back to where you're from. You came from North Carolina, or that's where you grew up. I believe. Where did you go to school before you came to graduate school here?
I grew up in Gastonia, North Carolina, and then I went to undergraduate at UNC Asheville, and then I did my master's at UNC Greensboro, just down the mountain in Greensboro.
Okay, so you were a real Appalachian boy before you came to UL Lafayette.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, this novel called A Land More Kind Than Home is set in North Carolina. It's set in Appalachia, where you're originally from. And it is about, I guess, a kind of a culture that we know a little bit about. Most of us hear about the churches where, I guess some people would call them holy roller churches, where there is some snake handling and there's a lot of speaking in tongues. So we know a bit about it, but it's not particularly of our culture down here in South Louisiana. So it's a bit exotic for us.
Absolutely.
Tell us, first of all, why, because I know people are curious, why did you come down here for school?
Well, I came down to Lafayette for two reasons. The first reason was I wanted to go as far into the American South as I could. Growing up in North Carolina, I'd always loved Southern literature. I felt like a Southerner, you know, obviously, but I'd never really traveled for any extensive period of time outside of North Carolina. And so that was the first reason. And the second reason was I wanted to study under Ernest Gaines, who at that time, and I still believe this, is the South's greatest living writer. And so those are the two reasons that I came down here, and it changed my life.
The place or the professor?
Both,
Ernest Gaines?
Both. You know, there's this was such a rich cultural experience. I mean, to come down here, my first day here, I got lost in town, and the street signs downtown were in French, and I went to the post office downtown, and people were speaking French. It was an older couple speaking French, and I just thought, what have I done? Where am I? What is this place?
How far did I really want to go?
Yeah, exactly. And it was just so exotic and so foreign to me. But I tell people that if I hadn't ever left North Carolina, I wouldn't have seen it as clearly as I saw it after I came here. Because this is so culturally rich and so distinct from Western North Carolina that it made the differences between the two so extreme. And so I got to live in this incredible place for 5 years and have all these wonderful experiences.
And yet your own traditions became sharper to you.
I think so, yeah. I tell people that, you know, when you're doing laundry and you can't decide whether a sock is blue or black, you hold them up side by side and you think, how could I have ever thought this sock was blue? You know, before I came down here, you just say the South. But now I feel like I should say the Souths, because there's not just the South. It's different almost on a city-by-city basis, especially in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
I mean...
Well, tell us a bit more about your experience with Ernest Gaines. You did come down here, mm-hmm. and he is a Louisiana writer. Most of his subjects are set specifically in Louisiana. So you had read all of his work before you arrived. What was that like, having known him through his work and then coming and working with him?
Well, I'd always known his books and stories, but I never knew his biography, really. Mm-hmm. And I never knew that he'd left Louisiana in 1948, because there were no schools in Southwest Louisiana for African American children, I believe beyond elementary school, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And I never knew that he wrote about Louisiana after he'd left it, or got the idea to kind of recreate home because he'd had to leave home. And so I took that very seriously when I was studying under him, because I came down here wanting to be a writer, but I had no idea what that meant. Mm-hmm. I just thought you wrote stories and you sent them off and everybody loved them and you made a bunch of money. I'm kidding. Because everybody knows writers don't make any money. But I didn't know what it meant to be a writer. And so when I found out that he was writing about home after leaving home, I thought, well, I can do that. I can try to do that. And I feel like once I left North Carolina, it became clear that I was just going to write about North Carolina. Mm-hmm. That even though I was living in Southwest Louisiana with its swamps and its, you know, salt water and its wonderful food, I could still write about snow and mountains and fresh water mm-hmm. and all of these things that I missed back home. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I hadn't studied under him that would have been as apparent to me.
Mm-hmm. So you weren't coming here for new material.
No, not necessarily. I don't know if I could ever write about Louisiana. I mean, I love it so much. I consider it a second home. Coming back today, I mean, this is the second time I've been back, and I love it. You know, I drove past where I used to live and drove through Girard Park and had lunch downtown, and I'm on campus, and I love it. I just, this is such an incredible city. But it's not in me the way that North Carolina is. Mm. And I think that, you know, and by no means comparing myself to him, but I think Gaines would say the same thing. San Francisco isn't quite in him the way that
I don't think I've ever
Louisiana
read a story
is.
By him about San Francisco.
Yeah. He has one called Christ Walked Down Market Street, which I think is his only San Francisco story. So,
Well, how did he guide you to create those stories? You had the material within you, but what was it about his tutelage here? What did you learn most that made you feel like you really could write the story of your culture?
Well, from him, I think I learned to write about what you know, to write about what's important to you, and, you know, to try to get things right. Like, I see him as a writer who very much cares about the land, who very much cares about the customs of people and their voices and their dialect. And that's something that I really wanted to get right. Mm-hmm. And I think I also learned the ethics of writing and how to be a professional writer, where you sit down and you work the same way that someone else goes to work every day. And some days you have good days at work, some days you have bad days at work, but you go to work and you do your job. Mm-hmm. And so I really got that from him. And that was really important to me, to try to get things right, to try to get things accurate culturally, geographically. That was really important to me.
Mm. What do you think a writer does for other people when they get their job right? Well, you talk of it as a job, and most jobs mean we're doing something that affect other people.
Yeah.
What is it you're trying to do?
Well, I think, you know, I don't want to condense writing down to a product like, you know, a sandwich or a camera or anything like that. But I think that when writers do their job correctly, you get to disappear in the pages and inhabit a different place for a while. And when I moved down to Louisiana, I started rereading North Carolina writers like Thomas Wolfe and Clyde Edgerton and, you know, Gail Godwin and Doris Betts, and I got to go back home in their pages because I felt like they got North Carolina right. And, you know, if somebody reads A Land More Kind Than Home, maybe they've never been to Western North Carolina, and hopefully I got it right enough to where if they ever go there, they think, man, sweet gums do grow this close to water, or, you know, this is what winter feels like, you know, in Western North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And so I think it gives you a place to go. You know, the most difficult times of my life, I can remember what I was reading. And I think that's what good writing can do for you, or what I hope my writing can do for someone.
Well, it's been effective, obviously. The blurbs that you have on this book from people like Gail Godwin and Clyde Edgerton really say that. They say that you allow them to go into another place, that you really do create this world. And they're very, very complimentary about this book. If you have just tuned in, we're talking about the novel A Land More Kind Than Home. Wiley Cash, a young novelist, it's his first novel. It's been published by HarperCollins. the William Morrow Division, really wonderful for a first book. Wiley got his PhD here at UL in English 4 years ago and now teaches at Bethany College. A Land More Kind Than Home. It is a terrifying book in so many ways. It's page-turner. I have to say, I read it all last night.
Oh, really? Great.
I couldn't put it down. I won't say what time I finally went to sleep. But you are drawn into it immediately. What when you first started thinking about this first novel, this book, how did you create this story?
Well, I was taking a class with another professor at UL, Reggie Young, and he brought in, it was an African-American literature class my first semester, and he brought in a news story about a young autistic boy on Chicago's South Side in an African-American church that the congregants were trying to heal, and they were laying their hands on him, and when he fought them, they laid him on the floor and laid across his body and ended up smothering him and killing him. And I remember asking Dr. Young, I said, are you going to write about this? And he said, no, I don't think so. And I said, okay. And so I felt I wanted to tell this young boy's story, but, you know, I'd never been in Chicago at that time. Mm-hmm. I couldn't speak for the African-American community, and so I just kind of let it sit on the shelf until the next semester when I was in a creative writing workshop with Dr. Young. I was in a fiction writing workshop. And I said, I think I want to try to write this story. And I came at it from different angles and different characters' perspectives. And the first draft I wrote of that was in his class. And so that's where the original idea came from. But once I moved that incident from Chicago and put it on the banks of the French Broad River in a small town in western North Carolina, I could hear the voices of the people. I could see the landscape. And I knew what a church like this, the mystery behind a church like this, what other people in the community would think about a church where people handle snakes and speak in tongues and handle fire and do faith healings and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so it really came alive to me.
Well, now you didn't grow up in that tradition, did you? Snake handling?
No.
You didn't. Your parents never
but
handled
it. But I adopted it, no.
Yeah. But that's interesting that you say that you knew what that would feel like, just in the same way that some of us here might never go into, I don't know, a certain honky tonks, but we know the feeling of it.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you, I mean, tell us what your thoughts were when you were growing up in North Carolina. How did you experience that world of these faith healers and the Holy Ghost rollers?
Well, I was raised in a Southern Baptist church. And so, you know, I was familiar with people laying hands. I'd heard people speak in tongues. But snake handling is a completely different thing. That comes from the book of Mark, chapter 16, verses 17 through 18, that says, at the Pentecost, it said that you will know true believers by these signs that will accompany them. And the signs are they'll be able to pick up snakes without being bitten. They'll be able to drink deadly things and not be harmed. They will speak in new tongues, and they will lay their hands on the sick, and the sick will get well. And so these holiness believers, they believe in order for the Bible to be the literal word of God, somebody has to be doing this stuff. And there's a purity of belief in that, that's in some ways admirable, as shocking and as amazing as it is. But I also think that it also can grant a community a kind of exceptionalism that makes them believe their own myths. Hmm. And that's what happens with the preacher in this, Carson Chambliss. He's a guy who creates these great stories about himself and gives himself this exceptional history and these exceptional powers that aren't necessarily real, but he convinces enough people to believe in them. And I'm a child of the 80s. I grew up in Gastonia, right near PTL. So I watched Jim and Tammy Faye Baker build up this huge network and then believe these myths they've created and then collapse. And I know Jimmy Swaggart right down the road here did the same thing. And so as a child going to church in the 80s, I would go to church on Sunday morning and hear one thing. And then we'd go to lunch and people would talk about Jim and Tammy Faye and I'd hear another. Mm-hmm. And I remember being 9, 10, 11 years old and thinking, there's some kind of disconnect here. There's some kind of something's wrong with this community of believers. People aren't doing what they say they're believing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the holiness movement's always been really interesting to me. I mean, these people will literally believe something to death, and they will tempt death whenever they feel moved. And I knew if a faith healing gone wrong was going to happen in North Carolina, it was going to happen in a church like this.
Well, and as you said, there can be a purity about it. But if something does go wrong, mm-hmm. if there's a certain character like the pastor in this novel, it can go really bad.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So once you had that idea, how did you start gathering your characters? There are three narrators in this book. How did you choose which narrators to use in the story?
Well, the primary way is that I knew that this boy, he doesn't speak, and he tragedy befalls him earlier in the book, and he couldn't tell his own story. And so I gave him a younger brother who's 9 who harbors this secret guilt about his perceived role in this tragedy, and he's a narrator. And then I created a church matriarch and a cultural conscience in this elderly woman named Adelaide Lyle, and she really represents a purity of faith. She knows this church is going down the wrong course, and so she takes the children out of the church and leads them kind of in her own little Sunday school. But then 10 years later, one of them is called inside, and he dies. Mm-hmm. And so this is something she kind of saw coming. And then the final narrator is a local sheriff whose own life has been touched by tragedy, who toward the end of his career is charged with discovering why this little boy's in this church with newspaper over the windows. Why would a mother let her child face this kind of danger? Why is nobody willing to talk about it? And I really felt like each of these narrators represents our approach to faith and mystery in many ways. You know, the younger brother represents skepticism. He represents doubt and questioning in many ways. As children often do, they ask questions about religion that sometimes adults don't know how to answer. And Adelaide represents purity of belief. I mean, she's a true believer, and she knows what's happening is not right. Mm-hmm. And she knows that the only thing that can save this community is the same thing that may destroy it. Mm-hmm. And the sheriff represents the rational mind trying to sort through facts.
You're so happy when he talks. He seems
he represents
such clarity,
the reader in many right. ways. Mm-hmm. You know, he's kind of the reader's guide. He's mm-hmm. trying to figure this out along with you. And he's the voice that I enjoyed writing in the most. He was the voice that was truest to my own as a grown man looking back on a lot of these things.
Mm-hmm. Well, and another thing that struck me was just how much happens in a very tiny community. Mm-hmm. The intricate relationships and the wildly varying degrees of religious belief and different styles of religion. Because it's not the only church in town, mm-hmm. But obviously it seems to have this powerful hold over people. And I was listening to something else. You were, I guess, another interview, and you mentioned a film that was done in the 60s called Holy Ghost Church or Holy
People,
Ghost
Holy
People.
Holy Ghost People.
Holy Ghost People. And I would highly recommend that. Mm-hmm. Anyone who's interested in your book, seeing that, I mean, it may be familiar to you and you seeing it. You grew up in North Carolina, you know, that West Virginia area. And so it seems quite comfortable to know that those people are there. It's completely outside the realm of my experience. And it really does help with this book. These characters are not something out of myth. They're real people, and real people worship like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Holy Ghost People is from 1967, and it's made by a documentarian named Peter Adair. And he passed away maybe a decade ago, but he just goes into a church in Scrabble Creek, West Virginia, and turns on his camera and just steps back and records, you know, a couple hours of this service. And they speak in tongues, they dance, they get the snakes out, they play rock and roll music. And the first time you watch it, it's unsettling. But by the second or third time, it's almost hypnotizing when you watch it. And a lot of people have written about snake handling. There's a guy named Dennis Covington who wrote a great book called Salvation on Sand Mountain. There's a guy named David Kimbrough who wrote a book even before that called Taking Up Serpents. And these two men go into these churches with a critical eye and a reporter's eye, and they both end up handling snakes because it's so intoxicating. These people are so charismatic and so their belief is so powerful that, you know, it's almost like a drug. It's almost like this charge that you have to go back to the well and refill a couple nights a week, you know.
But not in every – in those instances, obviously, it hasn't become evil. But in this book, in your book, there is an evil there.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to go back to what you were saying, that somebody thinking they're too exceptional.
Absolutely. I mean, that kind of thing gets everybody in trouble. People have asked me, you know, did you set out to write a book with an evil religious leader? Mm-hmm. And I said, no, this guy could have been a politician. He could have been a financier like Bernie Madoff. He just happened to be a religious leader. And when people believe that the myths they create about themselves, that's when they get into trouble. Mm-hmm. That's when they start believing that the law or an ethical code doesn't apply to them. And that's certainly the way the preacher in this book is. And the South's got a long history of rogue preachers. I mean, they've got a long history of that, you know, Good Country People with Flannery O'Connor or Night of the Hunter, which is set in West Virginia. So I'm not touching on new territory by, in that respect, but I think it's a powerful figure, and I think it's a powerful belief and powerful sway these people hold over us. I mean, my grandmother wrote checks to Tammy Faye Baker like it was her job. And they didn't have a lot of money, but she fired them off every week, you know.
Well, and the character of the mother, it was very interesting to me because I couldn't understand her for a long time, the power that that church had over her. And later at some point, her father-in-law is talking about her as a young girl when we first encounter, and just saying she comes from religious people, they're religious, there is no getting away from that, she is like that. That was a moment that changed, and I began to understand her in the book.
He says something like, you know, people don't change no matter how bad you want them to change. And I think that people need things in their life. And the mother her in this novel, I mean, she needs someone to talk to. She needs someone to make her feel relevant and valid and good,
and someone who's a conduit to God.
Exactly. And if he happens to be if he happens to speak for God, how much better. And she finds that in this minister, you know,
even after her son is killed.
And there's an old saying that says, you know, you don't always get what you need, but you always get what you're looking for. And she gets what she's looking for, and it certainly is not what she needs.
Again, if you have just tuned in, my guest is Wiley Cash. He has just published his first novel with HarperCollins, William Morrow. He is in town. He teaches at Bethany College in West Virginia, but again, got his PhD here. A Land More Kind Than Home is set in North Carolina, an amazing small town, preachers, and just fascinating characters. He will be reading tonight at Barnes & Noble here in Lafayette, and you'll be signing copies of your book.
Absolutely.
It's going to start at 7 o'clock. Are you going to be reading first?
I think I'll probably talk a little bit about the book and then maybe read for just a few minutes. I won't read for a real long time, I promise.
And I think people can find a short video, I think, on YouTube with you kind of talking a bit about Ernest Gaines. You have a website, don't you?
I do. It's just wileycash.com, wileycash.com. And I have some videos. I have a video trailer, and you can read an excerpt from the novel, and there's some interview video and things like that.
Okay. Well, again, this is quite a page-turner, and if you start it, it's going to be hard to put it down. And I know people are going to be wondering, what are you working on next? How can you top this one?
I hope I can. I'm working on a second book now, so we'll see.
Okay. So set in the same area, West Virginia,
it's
North Carolina?
It's set just down the mountain in Gastonia, which is where I grew up. And it's about a washed-up minor league baseball player who kidnaps his daughters from a foster home.
All right. There's a good
start.
And
goes on the run. So
are you glad to be back in the area where you grew up?
Yeah, I am. It's nice. I've been on the road for the past 2 weeks. So I went down through North Carolina and South Carolina, and that was wonderful. Good to go back. I got, like, Wednesday of last week, I went back to the library where I got my first library card when I was 6. It was just wonderful. And getting to come back here, you know, when I lived in Lafayette, KRVS is like the information hub for Lafayette. And getting to come back here and do this, I mean, it's just wonderful. The whole thing's just been incredible.
Well, we're so happy to have you in our studios as well. You can hear Wiley this evening at Barnes & Noble in Lafayette, 7 o'clock. His new book, A Land More Kind Than Home, which is a quote from what, Wiley?
Thomas Wolfe, You Can't Go Home Again. Which is ironic.
Or maybe you have to find a new home.
Kind
than the first. It's available through his website. Tonight, you'll be signing copies of that. You can find it anywhere. Thanks so much, Wiley, and hopefully we'll have you back for your second novel.
Absolutely.
And now a look at what's happening in the arts and culture in South Louisiana. There are performances at the Liberty Theater by the Eunice Public Library. Started today and continue tomorrow. That will be a performance by Al Simmons at 10 o'clock in the morning and all the following week as well. For a complete listing of Storytime performances, you can call the Eunice Public Library or go to their website. Grigri Productions will continue its run of True West, performed by Brock Huffpower, Blake Huffpower, Dominic Cross, and Winnie Darfenbache, directed by Bruce Cohn. The play will be performed at Theater 810 in downtown Lafayette. That's at 810 Jefferson Street. You can purchase tickets by calling Theater 810. You can get them at the door, but it is a very small, intimate theater, just about 50 seats, so you may want to get your tickets ahead of time. You can also email them at theater810@gmail.com. Louisiana Public Broadcasting invites you to a special screening of LPB's new documentary this Thursday, May 31st at 6 o'clock at the Acadiana Center for the Arts. That's at 101 West Vermilion Street in Lafayette. This Saturday is the second annual Bluesberry Festival and Cook-Off. 6 o'clock at the Blue Moon Saloon. There will be lots of music, blueberry tasting. There will be some performances by Henry Gray and the Cat. And there will be a Best Dressed in Blue Award as well. You can also buy blueberry bushes there. That's this Saturday, the second annual Bluesberry Festival and Cook-Off at the Blue Moon Saloon in Lafayette. The Lake Charles Community Band will host its Catch a Concert series every Monday in June at 7 o'clock. Traditionally, the concerts are at the Civic Center Arcade Pavilion, but this summer, this June, the series will be on the front lawn of the Lake Charles Civic Center. That will be this coming Monday at 7 o'clock. The McNeese Department of Performing Arts will present Yusul Kim of South Korea in a piano recital June 8th in Ralph Squire's Recital Hall in the Shearman Arts Center. The Bag Mat Ministry will have a workshop this Saturday at Grace Presbyterian Church. They are making sleeping mats for the homeless from recycled plastic shopping bags. If you'd like to join them, Saturday, June 9th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., all are invited. Hobgoblin Hill Puppets will perform Goldilocks Goes to the Wrong House at Cité des Arts, Sunday, June 10th at 3 o'clock. We'll be speaking with Alice Wallace of Hobgoblin Hill Puppets next week about that performance. Vermilionville will host their annual Creole Culture Day on Sunday, June 10th. They will be honoring Goldman Thibodeau with the annual Richard Catalan Senior Creole Heritage Award. For more information, you can contact Vermilionville. And for a listing of programs on KRVS, you can stop by our website, krvs.org, clicking on the schedule button. You can also podcast many of our locally produced programs. Just search for the program you'd like to hear, and you can listen to archived programs there or download a program for listening to later on. Stay tuned to KRVS this afternoon and evening. We're with NPR's All Things Considered from 4 until 6. From 6 to 7, Terry Gross hosts Fresh Air. And at 7 o'clock, we join Judy Carmichael's Jazz Inspired, Mr. Bob Gushrow's The Music of Yesteryears at 8, Big Band Swings at 9, Selected Shorts at 10, Music from the Hearts of Space at 11, Beat Current at midnight, and La Veonera at 1 o'clock in the morning. In just a moment, we join NPR's All Things Considered.
KRVS Lafayette, Lake Charles.
What's happening musically in Dakar? Joburg, Kinshasa, Port Spain, Havana, Accra, Dar es Salaam, Cairo, Paris, New York. Well, tune in this week and every week to find out on Afropop Worldwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday night at 8 on KRVS.
From that split second onward, when he did not salute the guard and the tram started, just then, the world broke into sound.
A prisoner is recalled to life this week on Selected Shorts from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 10 p.m. on KRBS.